a new cybersecurity framework, and trouble at school. Welcome to another episode of the Security Management Highlights podcast from ASIS International. Every month, we focus on the trends and topics the world needs to know about your world of keeping information and people safe. I'm your host, Brendan Howard, and today we speak to Security Management Magazine's own Megan Gates about the latest and greatest cybersecurity framework from the government. And we dive into the effects of COVID-19 and social media on student behavior, as well as school threat assessments, with Amy Lauder, who is a nationally certified school psychologist and director of student safety and well-being in her district. First, Megan Gates, senior editor at Security Management Magazine, is somebody who follows cybersecurity for her day job, and she is excited to share the big changes in the cybersecurity framework out of the government agency, NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology. But first, Megan, let's take a trip back in time.
Yeah, well, we could take a little trip down memory lane. So I started at ASIS Security Management in the summer of 2013. And then, you know, the following year is when NIST released the Cybersecurity Framework 1.0, the very first version. And it was huge because it was the first framework of its kind for how especially critical infrastructure and government agencies were supposed to sort of structure their cybersecurity and how they ran it, how they oversaw it in their organizations and structured their management of cybersecurity. And so it really laid kind of the foundation for how we talk about cybersecurity management from a business perspective. So that's been something following for the past 10 years. They've done a few updates since then, but nothing as major as the update that we saw on Monday, the 26th of February, with the official release of the 2.0 version.
Okay, and I want to mention, you mentioned, hey, this was set up and released in its final version, 1.0, in 2014, by presidential order for the federal government and for critical infrastructure. And so it was really leaning that way, but I think people have talked over the years, it started to bleed out from there, that either maybe the first people who had contracts with the federal government or they didn't have a framework at all. So like, I heard about this, maybe I'll dip into it. In what you saw, how did it slowly bleed out from its federal government critical infrastructure beginning point outward into the world?
You know, as you mentioned, this was something that was required for government agencies, but everybody else, this was a voluntary framework when NIST released it. So they were not required to adopt it. But then you saw, you know, the framework itself, it is easy to understand. It's written for a business level audience. You do not need to be a cybersecurity expert to read through this document and understand what it's trying to communicate. And so I think that was really attractive for people who are in cybersecurity in the private sector, the business, and really looking as like, how do I communicate cybersecurity risk and its management and what my team is trying to do to the rest of the business organization? So maybe I can use this framework that's developed by this group of renowned experts that the world really looks to develop tools like this to structure how cybersecurity is managed at my organization, even though it's not required. And so NIST started seeing, you know, more businesses adopting it, asking for tools and resources of, hey, I'm not in the critical infrastructure space, but like this has been very helpful and I want to use this. Can you give me assistance on how to best do that?
I have a question from your perspective and talking to people over the years. Were the security professionals who put it to work, were they putting it to work mostly because they need a framework for their own work, or were they using it? It's very popularly used because, as you said, it's very understandable. It's not very long. It's not full of a bunch of jargon that executives and people in the C-suite would not understand. Were they using it as a tool to communicate to executives up, or were they using it, I need a framework, period, for my boots on the ground security processes?
I think the answer is both.
Okay.
It was like, you know, cybersecurity is sort of this, at the time, it was, you know, not a new field, but definitely an emerging field and something that was really making itself known as we were connecting more and more of our society to the internet and our business operations to the internet, which comes with its own cybersecurity risks. So people were looking for tools and frameworks on how do I manage and structure this and deal with some of these major, you know, data breaches and attacks that we started seeing in, you know, 2013 and on, as well as, you know, with those types of attacks and raising the risk profile of cybersecurity, you know, you have executive attention, you have board level attention, you have, you know, the Home Depot breach, Target, those were huge, major incidents for those organizations. So they required a board level and executive down approach to respond to them. And so practitioners were really seeking tools and ways to communicate about this very technical risk to people that do not have a technical background. And the cybersecurity framework really helped, I think, give them a little lexicon to be able to do that.
Speaking of lexicon, there are these famous five steps. It sort of breaks all the things into things from prevention at the very beginning, identifying resources, all the way to recovering from an attack. And it sort of breaks everything into these five categories. Version 2.0, what are the biggest changes in version 2.0 that's just been released?
Yes. So the major one is, as you mentioned, those sort of five core functions of the framework. And then NIST, based on feedback that they've had during the process to update this framework, they decided to introduce a sixth function, which is called govern. So this means basically that the organization's cybersecurity risk management strategy, expectations, and policy are established, communicated, and monitored. So this is basically the risk management function for cybersecurity. And that's a big change to sort of officially put that in the framework, as this is best practice guidance to make sure that you're doing all of these different core functions that will improve your cybersecurity posture, and recognizing that, you know, you need the oversight structure to do all of those things effectively. And so this gives practitioners sort of the different stages that they can develop this governance function in to make sure that they are, you know, then carrying out those other five functions.
This may be a what if question, but I'm wondering they had this nice visual of a pie that sort of walked you through, again, the steps, identifying the things you need to protect, protecting them, detecting threats all the way through. And govern now sits like a little inside of the donut, and it sort of touches all the things. Does anybody ever express any frustration or problems that result from this idea that, you know, security, we know what we're doing, and I know we want to be tied to the C-suite, but does this mean this govern thing, executives are touching every step of this all the time in all ways, and then it can feel like micromanagement? So I'm only wondering, does anybody worry about micromanagement in making risk management into a really big enterprise level thing? Does it ever cause problems?
I mean, I'm sure that's the case. You know, every organization is unique. You know, some boards want to be more involved than others. You know, some bosses are micromanagers, some are not. But yeah, I think, you know, the goal of the govern function is to really sort of establish cybersecurity as something that needs to be addressed from the board level. It is an enterprise risk that needs to be managed alongside all other risks that the organization faces. And then, you know, you need to have a team in place, you know, that's managing that cybersecurity risk and can communicate it to the board on how it affects other risks affecting the organization. So I think, like, you know, the ideal scenario is that you have a strong and empowered chief security officer, chief information security officer, and their team, you know, that are then working on these different aspects to sort of support the govern function and the framework, and then reporting that information out and up to the board and other executives so that they're informed of what's happening, but they don't need to be involved in the day-to-day decision making. The other thing about the framework is that I was listening to an event on Monday after the release of, you know, CSF 2.0 with the director of NIST, and then it was a panel of four cybersecurity practitioners from MasterCard, Salesforce, S&P, and General Motors, and they were kind of talking about how they've been using the framework and what they were excited to see in the 2.0 version. All of them said that they, you know, were glad to see the govern function added in, and mentioned that, you know, when the cybersecurity framework was first released in 2014, they were not at a position where they were ready, you know, to sort of have that as part of the core functions of the framework. But now, because of the maturity in the industry, that is something that is really essential and that people need. They also talked about, you know, these are companies with a global presence. you know, this is a framework that was developed by a U.S. government agency, you know, initially for U.S. government agencies and critical infrastructure in the U.S. But the panelists talked about how this is applicable, you know, to their international business. This is something that, because of the way that it was created with support from stakeholders and academics and experts from NIST and the cybersecurity community, you know, it's seen as kind of a gold standard, and it is applicable, you know, even those created in the United States for business sectors outside of the United States. And you've seen this in sort of the major download and adoption of the framework internationally. You know, it's helping guide a lot of conversations about best practices in cybersecurity, regardless of where you are in the world. And so it was just fairly interesting to hear this group of panelists talk about who are, you know, representing very different areas of the business world, talking about how they're all using the same framework to sort of create a baseline of understanding with their boards, their management teams, and, you know, within the organization itself of how we manage cybersecurity risk.
So go take a look at the cybersecurity framework version 2.0. The document itself is pretty short, although its resources online with implementation examples and profiles are more robust than they've ever been. Okay, switching from cybersecurity to children, namely children in schools in North Carolina. We've got Amy Louder, who's worked in school psychology since 2002 in Cabarrus County Schools in North Carolina. So recently reported in the news was that Louder's district has implemented new threat assessment guidelines and teams at schools. And Louder herself is the liaison with law enforcement who act as school resource officers. But we're going to veer slightly to the bigger picture here. What's up with the kids? How are they doing since COVID-19? And that's a complicated question, Amy tells us.
There was a lot happening at the same time the pandemic was happening. If you look at a surge in some of our mental health issues, the pandemic, I don't think necessarily caused it. I think some things were in action before. I think it possibly exacerbated some of our problems. And what we are seeing is, don't know if it's correlational yet or not, but between 2010 and 2015, there's research to show that was whenever cell phones and social media usage in teens and adolescents was really starting to take a different direction. Lots more activity with that. That's also whenever we started seeing some of the, I'm going to say, the growth in mental health concerns. And then the pandemic hit and we had social isolation. We had students in environments where they weren't used to being home all day. They weren't used to being isolated all day. We still are having issues even coming out of the pandemic of truancy and absenteeism. Students still not attending school like school was before the pandemic. And I think all those issues are causing some different attention and focus points for what we're dealing with students in schools and the concerns that they're generating. I'll give some examples. Conflict resolution, social skills, adjustments with the going from isolation to being in groups, expecting how to get along with others, conflict resolution with that. Emotional regulation. That's another really big skill for students, is trying to help them understand it's okay to feel angry. It's okay to feel these things, but it's what you do with them and how it impacts others. And so we have a lot of discussions going on in schools about, this may be how I feel, but I've got to be able to regulate my brain. We talk about the hand-brain model and being able to get my brain online so I can start making more logical decisions, not just acting out on these feelings.
So I'm wondering, that gets us a little closer to security and safety, which is conflict resolution, processing these things. Sometimes these things spark up into either kids are kind of attacking each other verbally or attacking each other physically. I'm curious, have the warning signs and the student behavior changed appreciably, either in numbers of events that happened in school, or have the warning signs about when you know a kid is about to get really mad and act out physically, if that's changed?
An answer for this is, there's not like a one size fits all, but okay, a possible answer is behaviors were there before. The way that kids are talking about them and demonstrating them may be a little bit different. And that's because of perhaps the increase in, let's just say, cell phone usage. Whereas typically, students may have a verbal altercation with each other, now they may be kind of doing some of this fighting on social media. And so some of the cyberbullying may be occurring. Same behaviors, but just maybe a different platform of how the students are demonstrating this. So we have all sorts of options that are occurring in schools these days. A lot of states are moving towards what is a anonymous reporting system that we can have where students can access this to where if they see something or hear something that's a little bit off, they can share that with a trusted adult. We know that the research supports it just takes one adult in a kid's life to really make a difference in their success at school. And so we're trying to encourage a sense of belonging, a sense of school connectedness. And through those relationships, we're finding if students just share, and there's a big difference between tattling and sharing important information. And so whenever they're able to share those details with a trusted adult, we can actually start to put the pieces of the puzzle together and prevent some serious violent acts in the schools.
Let me ask you, how does the timeline unfold? I think the impression of some people, there's a lot of verbal and emotional abuse happening on social media, but there's the old cliche, sticks and stones can break my bones, but words can never hurt me. So it's not like you're not getting punched and beaten. So when you're talking about threat assessments and warning signs and trying to think about things that could be going wrong in safety at a school, I think a lot of these things feel kind of outside the realm of things that security people are used to. How has there been crossover? If they just dismiss the social media stuff, I'm not in charge of it. We can't control it. If they bring it to our attention, we can talk about it. But it's not fights on campus. So how do you see these things playing together?
So I think what we can see, the outcome of some of the social media madness, if you want to call it, is students have platforms that they're able to speak with each other, whether it's texting, which is a little archaic. Most students, teenagers would rather do Snap or look through Instagram and share or TikTok, share some dances, look up things like that that's more relevant to their current developmental interest. But what we see is maybe it's not the fighting that's going on, but there's a lot of comparison that's going on with some of these social media platforms, especially with the research is showing with girls at younger and younger ages. There's a lot of depression, anxiety, self-harm, suicidal ideation that's going on for boys and girls. But with girls in particular, social media is having an impact on the way that they are looking at themselves. So their self-image is really starting to depreciate. It may even be that it's a well-intended post that someone has put up of trying to be inspirational. But that post, perhaps a girl looks at that and says, you know, I don't look like that. I don't have the great things she's talking about. And it starts this internal comparison of students whenever they're developmentally, their brain is not ready to handle some of those stages that they're being forced to go through with the social media usage. Teens and adolescents especially, I don't know if you're familiar with the U.S. Surgeon General's report that came out in 2023, but there is a lot of research that supports that this is a growing concern. It is a health situation that our nation has got to be able to address because we are seeing some negative consequences. Again, some of it may be correlational. We don't know exactly cause and effect, but we know that there is some tendency and we've got to put some attention on that.
So I now see the two paths. One path, mental illness, emotional health, digital well-being, and good habits about how to use this as a kid and having that modeled. And the bad part of that leading to self-harm or terrible problems with mental illness evolving into adolescence, into adulthood. So the other side, how does that tie into the other thing that people think about when they think of school safety is shootings, fights, physical bullying? Are those things wound together or do they kind of feel like tackling two separate things on two separate tracks?
The way that I look at it is physical and psychological safety are together. They're inseparable. A student, for example, if you think about a traditional classroom, if a student's sitting at a desk trying to learn math, we'll just make it very simple.
Yeah.
If the roof starts to fall in on them, that's a problem. They can't really learn that math. We've got to get their environment secure. So physical safety is very important. If they're also sitting at that same table trying to learn math, but they have a lot of things going on, maybe there are some issues at home, maybe they are having some friendship issues, maybe they aren't feeling exactly sure how they're supposed to respond to a feeling that they've got on the inside. or they don't know how they're supposed to regulate those feelings, then that may interfere with what they're trying to learn with math. And so again, the psychological safety, making sure that they're in a place where they have a sense of belonging, where they have a trusted adult they can go to talk about some of these issues. Maybe even if it's just learning that math is difficult for me and I need to talk to somebody about my learning style, being able to have a full culture in your school that supports academics, behavior, social emotional learning, mental health, it's all collaborative and it takes multiple people to really comprehensively address those areas.
Okay, I can totally see that. And that sounds really hard. Like you, again, it's easy to talk about that pie. You're like, there's this part, and these are all the people who need to work together. I'm wondering, at your schools, how do the school psychologists and the people who are really have the time to talk to kids and they're watching them and they're making their own assessments for mental health, how does that compare with whatever security people are trying to make threat assessments based on bullying, fighting, making sure there are no weapons at school? So the physical and psychological, how do those two kind of groups get hand in hand? How have you seen it work well?
Great question, Brendan. So the way that it works comprehensively, school districts will be able to have administrators, law enforcement, and mental health positions, all of those different disciplines working together. So it could be that your principals and assistant principals represent your administrators. Your law enforcement could be your school resource officer in your building, if you're fortunate to be able to have an SRO in your building. Your mental health staff could be a school counselor, a school psychologist, a school social worker, or even a school nurse. All those different folks, if you can have them all in one building, that's ideal.
Okay.
If you don't have them in one building, you can still access those services and supports through partnerships with your community organizations, through agency collaboration. So still having those, we'll call them the three pillars, administrators, law enforcement, and mental health, by using all those different lens, you're able to then, let's take a behavioral threat assessment. If a student is making a threat, you can then help them determine, now does the student actually pose a threat? And let's look at those three different pillars to determine from their lens, is there something going on here? When we collaboratively start looking at the situation and the statement the student made, is there something going on that we need to investigate a little further? We want to be able to mitigate all sorts of violence, physical or psychological.
Is there a part that's changed for the law enforcement professionals in your schools in the last 5 or 6 years based on the social media changes, based on the different ways kids are communicating? Do they have to keep up on the social media stuff? How do they fit in?
So school resource officers are in very strategic positions. They are school resource officers. And so their perspective is more than just, I am there to check doors. I am there to put the flag up and down. I am there to do discipline. Like, discipline should not be something that a school resource officer does. Their work should be their triad model. NASRO uses a triad model. It really focuses on relationship building that SROs have with their students in the building. And so we really want to highlight those aspects of SROs, and that should be what their work is making those connections in the hallway, helping students understand law enforcement is a great thing to have, not being fearful of them. And I do know there are lots of circumstances where there are negative connotations with law enforcement. But truly, having an SRO in a school building who is doing the triad model and supporting that work to grow relationships with kids is a benefit to students.
And that is it for the latest episode of Security Management Highlights. And thanks to our guests, Megan Gates and Amy Louder. If you're interested in reading more about these topics, check out the links in the show notes. And if you got excited about something here, share this with your friends inside and outside of security management, because the world needs to know how vital and awesome this field is. And leave us a review wherever you listen to this podcast. We would really appreciate it. And you can find us at sm.asisonline.org. And hey, be safe out there.